You know, we're moving hotels.
No, but today is my last day. I've been here yesterday trying to get you this today. Ya mañana me voy la mañana.
Okay.
But
I wanted to make sure you knew that.
Where are you moving to?
We're moving to another Marriott only because this one is already booked for the weekend with some large conventions. And so we're out of here Friday morning.
Be closer to the airport.
I guess we will be. I don't know.
All right, Senator Mata, we've gone over what this is about. So let me ask you the last part of the interview usually. What is leadership to you?
Well, leadership to me is either the ability of an individual or an individual who is willing to speak out on issues, and to me it's a political definition, obviously, who is willing to speak out on issues, whether they be controversial or not. I think that leadership requires that an individual follow his heart, regardless of what this side of the fence wants or this side of the fence. That's leadership, the ability to be able to also bring individuals together, to be able to work with various groups. So I think leadership is going to really mean different things at different times, but I think the ability to bring parties together is an excellent definition of leadership, and I could tell you that right now the state of Texas sorely needs it.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American political leader today?
It's really a tough question for me, because I really don't watch the national scene. I guess if I had to select one individual, it would be Governor Richardson here in New Mexico. I think that he's done an outstanding job both in Washington. He's done a super job with the people in New Mexico. He's highly respected in this area. He has credentials that go outside his own state. And I would imagine that if there's any Hispanic that is in a position to emerge as a national leader, it would probably be Governor Richardson.
Which is the most effective Mexican-American political organization?
Gosh. Well, sir, that's a tough one for me, simply because, I've worked with LULAC, I've worked with the GI Forum. They all have their pluses and they all have their faults. I would imagine that because of their, and I've seen this just the last several weeks, I would imagine that the GI Forum has perhaps a little bit more clout than some of the other organizations. And I think the reason for that is the fact that it's made up of individuals who have served in the military, who are able to not just get support from the Hispanic veteran, but I'm sure could cross the line and attract some help from Anglo veterans. And I think that gives the GI Forum perhaps a little edge over other individuals. And I think it's better structured, from what little contact I've had with them in the past few weeks, they've given me that appearance. But that's strictly a guess on my part.
Do you belong to any Mexican-American organizations?
No, I belonged to the LULAC some years ago, and I just never renewed my membership. And so as a result, the answer to that would be no.
What is the most pressing issue facing Mexican-Americans today?
Well, I think it's the same issue, Jose, that was pressing individuals and Mexican-Americans and Hispanics back in 1973 when I first ran for the legislature, and that's a question of a top-notch quality education. I just don't think that we are giving minorities, Hispanics in this case, the opportunities that they deserve, because we are simply unwilling in many states to appropriate the monies that are necessary to give young Hispanics an opportunity to go on to college and to be able to be competitive.
What are the underpinnings of tension between blacks and browns?
Unfortunately, we view each other as being competitors. If if you get a Hispanic to be promoted in a certain way, blacks will kind of look at that as obviously discrimination towards blacks in their position, and vice versa. I've seen this situation, for example, in Texas, very, very clear, where I know that there are some underlying feelings there as a result. For example, in Texas, I think blacks have moved much faster, especially at the state level, in obtaining jobs, and Hispanics have been a little slower. And I think all that is kind of, it's a sleeping giant out there that I don't know if we want to wake it up, because I don't know what will happen. And I think that happens in certain areas. I also know that that there have been some very good coalitions between Hispanics and blacks. If you go back to the history of the community college in San Antonio, the first black that was elected with the help of Hispanics, and that was G.J. Sutton.
All right, well, let's start then from the beginning of the way I told you the interview structured. Who are the Matlas? Your parents, grandparents, where they come from, why?
Well, yeah, my grandparents came from somewhere in Poland originally. That's on my grandfather's side. On my grandmother's side, they were from this part of the country. And they settled in Helotes many, many years ago. My dad must have been a third Polish Mexican, you know. I've got very little Polish in me, so Mexicano. But yes, on my side of the family, they came from Poland. My mother, her family came from Piedras Negras, Mexico, and so my mother is from Mexico. Obviously I'm about 99% Hispanic or Mexicano, whatever you want to call it. We grew up in a small farm. Dad had some goats and sheep, and we planted corn. The droughts of the 50, though, wiped him out, and he had to go work at Killifee like a lot of Mexicanos did. I mean, that was our savior. So I grew up on a small farm, attending small rural schools, where Hispanics were not looked upon very well.
Can we get some names to your mother, your father, your grandparents, sure, on both sides, if you remember all that?
I can remember my grandfather's name was Francisco, only because that's also my name. My dad's name was also Frank Matla, and that's my name, Frank Matla. In fact, for a while back, a few years ago, there were 5 Frank Matlas alive, so it's a popular name in the family. My mother is Epimenia. We call her Minnie because it's a lot easier. And she was in Alcalá. So, they've lived at the ranch all their lives. You know, they got married. That's where we grew up. I have a brother, Ralph, who was retired from Kelly, and a sister who is basically a housewife. And she has a nursing home because she takes care of mom, and a daycare center because she takes care of all the kids that are around the ranch.
And your wife and your family, your immediate family, your children?
Okay. My first wife was a Rosemary Segura from Marfa, Texas. I don't know if you knew Luis Segura, you know, who has been dead now some years. And then she and I were divorced on, I don't remember, just many, many years ago.
How is she related to Luis?
Sister.
Ah, okay.
That was Louis's sister. Yeah.
Any children from that marriage?
Yes, I have a son, Frank. He's about 40 years old. He's an internal medicine physician, does emergency room medicine at the Audie Murphy Hospital in San Antonio. My second wife is Helen Cruz from San Antonio. Lived in the old South San area. Her father and her mother had a grocery store and a ballroom, etc. And she and I have a daughter, Marcy, who is 18 years old. And my daughter had a baby about 2 years ago, and she's working and going to school. We have a granddaughter. Her name is Alina.
Alina?
Alina. A-L-E-E-N-A.
I'm glad you spelled it.
It's I don't have a lot of children. I have 2, and then of course my grandchild. And my daughter is struggling, having a baby, you know, out of wedlock has made it tough on her. But I'm very proud she's facing up to the responsibility.
Do you know what prompted that Polish immigrant to come? Do you know what his name was? Do you know what prompted your wife's family to come from Piedras Negras?
No, the truth is I really don't. You know, the only reason I know that they came from Poland, well, Dad used to tell us that they came from that area. But Father Janta, who's now Bishop Janta, and Bishop Flores were in Poland some years ago, and they came back with pictures of the name Matla that was on the tombstones at some of the cemeteries. So apparently there is, you know, some validity to that. My mother, obviously, they came to San Antonio, my belief, it's my understanding, simply because of the very difficult times to make a living in Mexico, and so they came to the United States.
Okay. Well, let's begin with that early childhood that you said was...
Let me go check it just so that I...
All right, I was asking you about the early childhood.
I was born at, I guess, Santa Rosa Hospital in San Antonio, like a lot of Mexicanos were. I grew up in what people call today Helotes, but it's Los Elotes. It's a small community, or it was a small community back then. That's, you know, approximately, I'm going to say 30 miles from San Antonio. I grew up, you know, milking cows, planting hay, baling hay, you know, feeding the chickens, everything that basically you can think of a young man doing on a farm. And there were good times, they were difficult. My father was not rich. My dad was, I guess in a way we could say he was dirt rich and money poor. And so we lived off the land most of the time. We didn't have pork chops and ribeyes and T-bone steaks. Not beef anyway, you know.
You had lamb and goat and chickens?
Well, sometimes we had goat and then most of the time deer, because I mean, even though most of the time it was illegal, I mean, that was the way we survived.
How big was the spread?
Well, there's 10 brothers that had 1,000 acres. My dad had 100.
All matlas?
All matlas.
And yes. All contiguous?
Yes.
Is that land still together?
No. I've had some of them that have sold, some of the families that have sold property. And unfortunately, it's not contiguous anymore. But
is yours?
Is ours. Ours is. My brother and my sister and I have not sold, and I know I'm not going to sell. I'm going to give it to my children.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when were you born?
I was born in 1937, January 23rd of 1937. I'm 66, I'm, you know, pushing 67, as much as I hate to admit it. But I stayed on the ranch probably around my mid-20s. I attended school at Helotes, what they call Helotes Elementary.
Well, tell me about that.
And it was an interesting time. It was difficult simply because I spoke only Spanish. I didn't speak English. And there was a tremendous communication gap between myself and the teachers that they had. It made it very difficult. And I think part of my difficulties in my educational background come from the fact that I really didn't get a real solid educational foundation in my early years. I have always had to struggle when it's come to the academics, simply because I think I had that weakness. I just have to work harder than most people. But there were some interesting times, and there were times when eventually, you know, some of us were able to be accepted by the Anglo community much more, simply because we were able to play good baseball or softball. And it's interesting how it's been the athletics, unfortunately, that have led to our acceptance rather than our intellectual ability. But then I think a lot of youngsters had the same problem I had, you know, the weak educational background.
Did you bus to school or walk or bicycle or?
Well, we did a combination. I grew up at the original ranch house, which is about a mile from each side of the highways. And so I would walk either to my aunt's, and then she would take us the extra few blocks We'd get on a bus. We'd ride a yellow, big old yellow bus. And they'd take us to school, bring us back.
So can I assume that because of that, you didn't do many school activities?
No school. Like, everything we did was taken out of class time. So if we practiced baseball, we would do it during the long recess. Can you stop it so I can go?
Sure. We're recording again. I was asking you about the extracurricular activities at school. You said only the recesses in school time.
Yeah, we didn't. We would play sometimes after school, but then parents have to be responsible for picking us up. And so we really didn't have, in any of my elementary or junior high, or what we call middle schools now, no organized activities.
So what were some of the fun kid things? Did you play Little League? Did you go to the church? What church? Did you have a car, first car, first?
I'll tell you what the fun things were that we did. It was basically on the ranch, and it was a question of cousins getting together. You know, we'd get together simply because we lived so far apart from other neighbors. It was really, really a rural community. 3 miles from our house was the only store in town and garage, and that was it. And then the Catholic Church, Our Lady of Guadalupe, which was right next to the elementary school. And outside of that, that was it. We did a lot of things for fun. When we were in school, one of the biggest things that the young guys wanted to enjoy doing was every time someone had a tough test and hadn't studied, they would go set fire to the Johnson grass. And of course, then we'd all get out of class and we'd have to put out the fire. I guess that was a fun thing, you know. But we did play softball. We played softball periodically. Horseback riding was very much a part of it. Obviously, also hunting, you know. I made a lot of the money that I made as a youngster. I made it because of trapping. I would have traps throughout the ranch, and I would have to get up early, 4 o'clock in the morning, go run my traps, make sure that I got my animals back in time to clean them and stretch out the hides, and then, you know, reset them and all that, so I could go to school.
What kind of animals did you trap?
Ringtails, fox, and raccoons, mostly those three areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't pay us a whole lot, you know. And of course, you know, the dog generally got in and is the one that, if you had a good dog that knew how to go in and just hold the animal there until I could hit it in the head, and you'd have a good hide. But a lot of times, you know, there'd be a vicious fight and it'd have holes in it and they'd give you 25 cents for the darn thing. Almost not worth, you know, cleaning it. But you know, that's how I made my money, was basically through trapping.
Did you have a good dog?
I had some good dogs.
Remember them? Who were they?
Well, the first dog that I had was really, really, the first dog that I used for hunting was my dad's dog. It was a Spot. Had one eye, because the other one had been popped out with a branch. It was a heck of a hunting dog. My very, very first dog was a dog named Tippy. He was a mutt, and he was vicious. I mean, he was a good fighter. He was a huge dog. And my Uncle Joe, and I kind of grew up with Uncle Joe and Aunt Susie, who were on that same ranch, because my mother was gone every third week to San Antonio to take care of her mother, who was blind. And so Dad went off to work, and I was by myself. I'd be with Uncle Joe. When his dog died, he asked me if I could leave Tippy with him. And my dog was over there till he was about 18 years old. When he lost his teeth and his eyesight and couldn't hear, he came back home. But he was a good hunting dog, and I would go pick him up and we'd go hunting. Then after that, I guess my other dog was Blue. It was a Blue Heeler. And he didn't last long. Somebody poisoned him. But we had all kinds of dogs. I guess which one was the best? My dad had a collie called her Poppy. On command, she'd go get the goats. She'd go through the whole 1,000 acres and bring them back in. It's an amazing, amazing dog.
So, by reference of what you just said, did the Madla extended family work the 1,000 acres as one unit, or did y'all have separate plots, or did you collaborate sometimes on crops
well,
or equipment?
You know,
or?
Yeah, we worked it as a unit to a greater degree. Uncle Joe Torres had his field, Dad had his fields, and Uncle Jesse had his fields. And, you know, we would basically work all three fields. Yeah, we'd help each other, bale. you know, when it came time to baling hay, we had only one baler, so everybody got together and baled hay. I hate that job.
But it built you up. Those things were about 70, 80 pounds a piece.
Oh, it was tough. It was hard work.
I remember doing some of that. Yeah. Well, when did you finally start having a social life other than just being on the farm? Was that high school?
Well, yeah. I think once I got into high school, I started to have some kind of a social life. But it was still very difficult because I went to Central Catholic. And I would get up early.
Well, that's in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. We would drive in every morning on a Model A Ford. Top speed, 35, maybe 40. You know, we had a good wind blowing in behind us. And that was every day, every day. So I didn't play football. I couldn't play basketball. I couldn't play any kind of activity simply because I was hitching a ride. And my two cousins didn't play any kind of sports and didn't want to. And so I had to be on that Model A when we left Central Catholic. And so I graduated from there in 1955. I guess to some degree I had a social life only because you know, families would visit the ranch. Congressman Gonzalez and his wife, for example, that was part of our social life. He would visit the ranch periodically. I don't know if you remember a gentleman by the name of Damasio Hernandez, mm-hmm. who was with a group called Help a Boy Camp. That was one of the few groups that my dad allowed to come on his land, only because they left it cleaner than what they found it. And Damasio did a great job with the young people that he brought there. A lot of them were juvenile delinquents. And I guess that was one of the earliest contacts that I had with individuals from outside the greater Helotes area. And it was a good experience. This is where I met Mario Cantu and then later on Hector Cantu and that family. And you know, even though a lot of people and individuals don't know this, the Cantus and the Madlas have been good friends for many, many, many years. They now have a restaurant there in Los Elotes called El Chaparral. Chaparral. Yep. They're running it, and actually it's really the daughter. The sister.
That's what I was going to say, because Hector runs the one over by Loop 410 or something, por allá arriba, ¿no?
Yeah, it's his sister and her husband that run it.
Well, why did the family decide to send you to Central and have that sacrifice, monetarily as well as the time to drive and get you back? And were there problems in Elotes with the high school?
No, not really. It's just that the high school was halfway in the town, okay? And mom and dad, and I wanted to go to Central, I really did, because my cousins were going there. And actually, I think it was more the fact that my cousins were going to Central Catholic that, you know, I begged and begged and fought. You know, it was expensive. It hurt my dad, I know. But they made the sacrifice. And you know, Central really helped me. Central really helped me.
All right, so you graduated, I guess, about the ending of the Korean War? Any military service in your background?
No. I tried to volunteer, but I'm totally deaf from my left ear, and nobody would take me.
Well, then, what did you do after high school?
Well, once I graduated, I went on to St. Mary's. You know, I worked part-time. I would work during the summer and save some money, and then I would go to school to St. Mary's during the regular semesters, spring and fall semesters. And then I work summers again. You and I we're probably taught by a mutual individual, a good friend that is now gone, is Dr. Bill Crane. And, you know, I have to credit him as one of the key individuals that helped me with my education at St. Mary's. I majored in political science. He was my graduate advisor. And, I mean, without Bill Crane, I wouldn't be sitting here today.
What prompted you to finish high school and not just be a farmer? What prompted you to go to St. Mary's?
Like I said, you know, baling hay, tough work. I mean, I had had my feet, you know, and I saw how Dad was struggling. You know, he would go to Kelly, come back, and he would go out to the field. We'd go out to work, and I said, man, I don't want any part of this. And so that motivated me. The ranch is a beautiful life. It's farm, beautiful lot, but it's extremely difficult. Extremely difficult.
Well, how did Bill Crane get to be the person that you wouldn't be here otherwise?
Well, I think it's because of the political science degree and the fact that, you know, I had that background. He required that students that were in his classes work in campaigns. And so as a result, I was involved with Pete Torres and John Alaniz, Judge Pena, and all those, you know, liberals from way back in those early days. And so that's one of the things that motivated me to run, was the fact that I enjoyed what we were doing. I enjoyed the give and take. I enjoyed the block work, walking and visiting with people. And
do you know why Gonzalez and Pena rifted and developed an animosity toward each other?
I really don't know. Both, you know, Henry and Albert, I consider to be good friends. I mean, I still every once in a while run into the judge at Pico de Gallo. He has breakfast there every morning, and every once in a while I'll go in and sit down and have a cup of coffee with him. But I don't know what caused that rift.
Okay. Well, what about the Paso? Did you belong to Paso? Did you get involved with that CARAM group, that lunch group that would meet there? Did you get involved with any of the student groups in St. Mary's, the Young Democrats?
Well, we were, let me tell you, the involvement that we had was very, very limited. I just don't recall the Young Democrats, to be honest with you. No, I just don't recall being involved with any organized group at the campus, to be very honest with you.
Well, when did you graduate from college?
59. And 59, I started teaching at Edgewood.
Ah, okay.
I taught at Edgewood, at Escobar Middle School. And I was there until 1962, and then I moved over to Northside. And I was at Northside for about 4 years, and then went to the community college, the St. Philip's College. I enjoyed teaching very much. It didn't pay worth a damn, but...
I assume you were teaching government or civics or Texas politics?
Civics and Texas history.
Texas history? Mm-hmm. Is that your minor?
History is my minor.
Okay.
Yeah, a minor in history.
Why didn't you continue on to a master's or a PhD and become a professor?
Well, I have a master's from St. Mary's.
Ah.
Dr. Crane kicked me through the bathroom. Yeah, I got my master's from St. Mary's, yes. And I probably should have gone on and gotten a PhD. I was lazy. I decided I wanted to teach and make some money, enjoy life.
Well, when did you marry the first time? Somewhere in between there?
Well, I think it was back in 61, 62.
So you were in college?
Yeah, I was in college, in that area.
And so, the child came right away?
No, after a while.
After a while, so, okay.
I was married, I think it was 8 years to Rosemary.
Okay, all right.
And,
Well, when did you renew then getting involved in campaigns, or did you ever stop? Or did you follow the Crane tradition of requiring your students?
Well, let me tell you, I lived in the South Sand School District, and there was awful turmoil going on in there. And so I decided I'd run for the school board position in 71, which was really, that was not my first effort at running, but we'll go to the other one later on. And so I got involved in that race, and I was successful. I was able to win that race. I wouldn't recommend running for school board to anyone. Nobody wins. I mean, it's just a very thankless job. And unfortunately, I'm not too sure that's the way we ought to be managing our schools. I have some real concerns about some of the school boards that exist around the state of Texas.
Well, those years, the Chicano movement has already begun. You got the farm workers striking in the valley. Mm-hmm. You got that march. You got some people in San Antonio involved with that. Mm-hmm. You got the beginning of the removal of Anglo superintendents in exchange for Mexican American. Like Cárdenas became the first one in Edgewood.
That's right.
And you had the beginning of OEO, and you had this young man, Edmundo Zaragoza.
He was a good friend.
Creating the first war on poverty programs. This is what I think happened. Now, correct me. What was all going on then?
Well, there was, I don't want to call it turmoil. I think there was a lot of activity on the part of the Hispanic or Mexicano or Chicano or whatever, Tejanos. We had, You know, Dr. Crane had a long list of what we were called, okay? And, you know, regardless of what name we used, there was a lot of activity in those early years. And obviously it was a time, I don't know when you say an awakening, but it was a time when a lot of young Mexicanos were getting involved in different movements, not all necessarily the same movement, but, you know, different groups. Some were running for public office, some were joining, you know, social clubs, others were joining political organizations that were really, really, you know, more active. And really, I think, La Raza Unida, you know, I had an opponent that ran against me on La Raza Unida. But it was an organization that I think that kind of jolted things, especially in the smaller communities, because it was possible for a La Raza Unida candidate to be successful at that level. I think it's very much like comparing them to my situation when I ran for the House of Representatives and won the second time, because I didn't have any money. I was able to do the footwork, and so I outworked my opponent. And I think those movements were starting at that time, and it's just an awakening of Mexicans, Americans in many areas.
Okay. Well, what group did you get into, and how did you get involved in this? Because there is a perception, and I don't know which came first, whether the Matlas built the machine in the south side, or the Tejedas in Matlas, or Zaragoza, or what?
Let me visit with you on that. I ran the very first race that I ran, first post that I ran for, was precinct committeeman. I don't remember what precinct. It was over there by the Max Martinez funeral home, because I was living on Morales Street at that time. And I learned my very first well-taught political lesson. I showed up in a suit, coat and tie, and my opponent was in tennis shoes and an apron, and she beat the tar out of me. It was a lesson worth made telling you. You have to identify with a voter. And the voters that were coming in were gracious and polite and everything, but my tie didn't fit in. So I learned a very good lesson. The second time that I ran was in 70, when I ran for the state house. It was an election that was at large, very, very difficult. And I got into that race because some students at St. Phillips kind of urged me on. We're talking about money and politics and what was more important, organization or money. And I had taken the side that it was money. They said, no, it's organization. So they said, well, you put up the money and we'll show you what organization can do. And it was a tough race. It was during that time that I met Lalo Solis, who was an old Democrat. You know, he and Bill Crane are the two people that I have to credit. He was the other one that helped me get here. He worked from the heart. Boy, that man knew more about politics than anybody I have ever met.
Well, him and Peña were the success behind Henry B. And Lalo was the street guy, and behind Albert was Olga.
That's right.
Who did the precinct work.
And, that's right.
Yeah.
They did. They were tremendous at organizing, yeah. But I lost my first race. Didn't do too bad. I came in third, but there were only three running, so you know. And then what happened?
Who did you lose to?
I lost to Paul Silber, who was an engineer, and it was an at-large race. He jumped in, and so did Tom Lee. And I tried to get Tom Lee out of the race, but he wouldn't get out. I had helped Tom Lee. He was one of the guys that I went door to door for, and decided not to do that. And, after I didn't make the runoff, I decided to support the conservative candidate. Labor didn't take that too well, but I wasn't happy that Tom Lee had jumped in when I was the first one to sign up for that seat, and I helped Paul Silber in that race, and
okay.
I got that paid off simply because it was that legislative session that we went to single member districts. And San Antonio had nine House members, and they were increasing it to 10. And Paul Silber made sure that the 10th seat was going to be over on my side of town, Southwest Bexar County. And so that really set up the seat that I was able to run for and win. And fortunately, it included almost all of the school district that I've been that I was on as a school board member.
Did you and Silver talk about that? Did you ask him, well, help me out, or I want to run? Or?
No. I didn't ask. I talked to Nelson Wolf, who was one of the House members. No, I didn't talk to Silver. I talked to Nelson Wolf, and apparently it was done. Okay. And then it was Lalo Solis who talked to him. It wasn't me. You know, I went with Lalo Solis, and he's the one who talked to him. And it went from there.
So 72 is when you ran again for the legislature. You resigned your position in school board, or
that's right. Or I resigned it and then I ran, and I was successful.
You raised money this time?
I raised a little bit more that time. Not a lot more. It's very tough to raise money. It's the only part of politics I really do not like. But yeah, I raised a little bit more money. I was successful. I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't. I would not run in the red with my campaign, so I didn't spend. I didn't spend any more money than I had. I made sure that I paid everything as I went, and I just hit the streets. I knocked on doors like I've never knocked on anything, and it paid off in dividends. I had in the primary election, I had an Armando Laurel and Raul Perez who ran against me. I was able to get by both of those individuals without a runoff. And then I had Mike Pagonis, who graduated from Central Catholic with me as a Republican candidate. And then, La Raza Unida attorney, Sandoval, Ruben Sandoval, was my opponent, yeah. And it was an interesting race. I knew Mike, I got to know Ruben Sandoval simply because at some of the functions that we had, he didn't have a ride, so, you know, I ended up having to give him a ride.
And that's interesting and dangerous, because in November, it's who gets the most votes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So that could have gone any which way. So how was your first experience in the House? What do you recall? Or how much money did you spend? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I really don't remember. $12,000, $15,000.
Okay.
Not much.
When you first got there as a freshman, what were the things that you recall as a striking memory of being the first freshman member?
Well, I walked on the floor and I said, man, what do I do now? You know, it's intimidating. It's intimidating simply because, I mean, you walk in, you've got all this huge group of people, you know, and you're wondering, I mean, am I going to be able to compete with these guys? It can be intimidating. I would imagine the first real barrier that I had to cross was making a decision as to who I was going to support for speaker, and I had several people that brought me along, felt that I ought to pledge to Price Daniels, which I did.
In exchange for what?
Nothing.
Nothing.
That's it.
What committee did you get assigned to?
I don't remember. So long ago, but no, I don't remember even asking. You know, and there were 76 new House members that session. Had we been smart, had we really learned our lesson from Bill Crane, we would have elected one of the 76 speakers, you know. One of those guys would have been speaker.
Kind of like Ben Barnes' story.
See, I came in right after Ben. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I was elected in 72. I took the oath of office in 73. Mm-hmm. I was on education, I remember, because I did ask for education, but I don't remember. I just don't remember the others. Environmental affairs, it's coming to me.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this pointed question. How could you afford to be there then?
I couldn't. My wife worked. My first wife worked. She was a medical technologist at Wilfrid Military Hospital. And I had a small consulting job. I mean, it didn't pay much, a couple of $100 a month, nothing, you know, nothing to really brag about. It was tough.
So why'd you keep doing this?
I had an interest in helping people, and I was willing to pay the price, and my family was willing to pay the price.
So how many terms did you spend in the House?
I was in the House from 73 to 90, to 93. I started my Senate term in 93.
Okay, well, before we get to the Senate thing, go back and tell me this story about this machine down in the south of San Antonio.
Yeah, I had forgotten about that. Well, so I was elected in 73, and I think it was, trying to think of when Frank DeHeather first. It was around 75, 76, in that area that Frank DeHeather gave me a call. And he wanted to meet with me because he was considering running against Tony Dramberger. And I remember that he and Edmundo Zaragoza, I believe, I think it was him and Edmundo, that drove to the ranch because I was spending the weekend with my family. And so they drove out there, we visited. And at that time, I was very high on the list of public school teachers. I was one of their darlings. They really liked me, and I had really voted with them 100%. I'd done everything they wanted. And he needed help getting the public school teachers to leave Dramberger and come with him. And so one of the things that I was able to do was to help him with some of the public school teachers, and they endorsed him in some of the areas, some of the school districts. And Frank, of course, became very, very successful. I don't think he needed my help. I think he could have gotten there without me. But we became close friends, and, you know, we were friends throughout, you know, his entire life. I had some tough decisions that I had to make. When he first ran for the Senate and got elected, I didn't support Frank DeHeather. I supported Tommy Atkinson. And I did that because Frank and I jogged every day, every afternoon, loyally. Went to the gym, we worked out, we jogged. And he told me towards the end of that session, I'm going to Harvard, I'm going to come back, I'm going to make money, I'm not running. And so somewhere between the time that Frank told me that and the time that I got a phone call from Frank, Tommy Atkinson called me and asked for my support. He says, I'm running against Glenn Kozman, I wonder if you'll help me. Frank's not running, I don't know anybody else is, you know. Yeah. And about a month later, I got a call from Frank advising me that not to commit. I said, Frank, I've already given my word. He says, you're not paying. It was his favorite saying. You're not paying attention. Listen. And I told him, Frank, I can't help you. I can't tell him. I said, my father told me that the one thing that nobody can take away from you is your word. And if you give it and you stick to it, just people will treat you with a lot of respect. And I just, it's very tough for me to tell someone, I'm going to do this for you and then not do it. And so I didn't. And he asked me, are you going to be critical? I said, no. I said, I'm not going to say anything bad about you because I don't know anything bad about you. I said, I'm in a very difficult situation because I've got two good friends running. And, you know, for a while, some of the Tejeda organization people were not happy with me, Frank Wayne, Mundo, and Bobby. But the one that just buried it very quickly was Frank Tejeda. Never looked back. It was over with. We worked together very well. We carried all our legislation. And missed the guy. I think he had great potential.
Well, how did you all decide things like him moving on to Congress, you running for the Senate, Cito now then going to Congress?
Well, the truth, you know.
Did you all come together, discuss things?
I didn't. I was not a part of that South Side coalition, Jose. You know, you had a coalition that was made up of Mundo, Bobby, Frank, John Longoria. And I was just on the periphery over here. When they needed my help, they called, okay? And, you know, I wasn't a dummy. You've got this powerful group over here. I mean, So I would help them, but I was never in the decision-making process of who was going to be a candidate for this, okay? I ran for the Senate only because Frank DeHeather called me in. During that redistricting process, Ciro Rodriguez was on the redistricting committee, and he had drawn that Senate district to go all the way into West Texas, deep West Texas. Frank had made up his mind that he was going to run for Congress, and he called me in, and he said, I want you to run for the Senate. I said, Frank, I'm happy where I'm at. I don't want to run. And the truth is, Jose, is that some of the Republicans in the House had asked me to run for Speaker, And I was moving around, and I had some of the Mexicanos, and I had some of the Republicans. Frank kept, you know, hitting. And, you know, and the speaker thing bothered me. I just didn't know if I was going to be able to put together the type of money that a successful speaker candidate would have, you know, to be able to fly in and attend receptions for member A, member B. And I knew that was going to be very difficult. And so I weighed the situation. And I think I made the right decision, only because some of the Republicans who were going to help me got defeated that particular time. So I made the right decision. I ran for the Senate, and it was a difficult choice, and it was tough simply because Cito had a tremendous lead on me. I knew that. I knew that I had an uphill battle simply because Cito had drawn the map. He knew what it was. He'd been out there a month and a half already. The thing that helped me was what I've always called the Aggie edge. My campaign manager was an Aggie, and he also worked for a uniform company, and he had all the accounts for all the constables and the sheriffs in all those small communities, and all he did was pick up the phone and call, you know. That was the Aggie edge. I also remember something that Jake Johnson told me, that the night that I was elected, he lost that night, I won, he called me. He says, I'm going to give you one bit of advice, this is it. He says, you're going to get up there and you're going to find huge, powerful lobbyists that don't want to share anything with the little guy. He says, take care of the little guy. And so when it came to the healthcare area, I was involved with chiropractors, I was involved with optometrists, I was involved with dentists against the Texas Medical Association, and it paid great dividends because TMA wasn't out in West Texas. The optometrists were. You had some dentists that were out there. And so it paid dividends because I went to those groups and I was able to pick up their support. I'll tell you a story on the Aggies about how the Aggie edge is important. I was sitting at a place called Onion West in Pecos, Texas, Reeves County. And I was sitting there with a gentleman who was the owner of the company, or the manager, I forget. And he says, well, he had given me a tour. He says, let me bring in the organizer for our Hispanic communities because I want him to have a chance to meet you. So the young man came in and, you know, we said hello and everything. He says, yeah, well, he says, your opponent was in here last week. He says, and you're going to have a really tough time out here, he says. His name is more Mexican than yours. I'm going, oh man, what do I do? And I looked
this
up.
This is Cito.
Cito, yeah. And I look up, and in the back, I see the Aggie bonfire in the big picture. So I told the guy, I said, you're an Aggie? Not the organizer, but the other guy. He said, yeah. He says, are you an Aggie? I said, no. I said, but my campaign manager is. He says, really? He says, who's your campaign manager? I said, Greg Garcia. He says, I was in the core with Greg. He turned to the guy and says, I don't give a damn how his name sounds. This is who we're helping. I can't believe it. And then things changed, of course. Jim Nowlin sent the district south about 3 weeks before the election. Cito dropped out of the race and then ran for his re-election to the House in Austin. And so I got elected without opposition. And in fact, I've not had an opponent since I've been in the Senate.
So in terms of fundraising, how much did you have to raise to run for the Senate as opposed to House district races?
Well, it's a big district. When I was in Alpine, Texas, and I talked to my wife, Helen, she told me we were $80,000 in the hole. Because she had ordered all those signs. I quickly called Dick Magoon and cut the order. But I had raised about $200,000. And it was a lot of money. So I was very, very nervous only because, I'm a school teacher. That's what I did. I taught school. And I knew that if I lost that race, there's no way I could ever pay back all that money. No way. And I was very, very nervous about it. Even after I won the race, I was nervous only because money wasn't coming in.
Well, now you're not talking about loans here. I mean, are you?
Well, you know, you you don't raise the money. Like, I had some of the stuff printed, you know, the guy, he didn't charge me everything up front. He held it off.
So how do you raise money?
Well, my money I've raised has been simply by having two or three basic functions during the year. I have a big one at the Royal Palace Ballroom, which is an annual function. It's geared towards people in the community. The tickets are free for them. I raise the money out of the lobby in Austin. And the tickets are $25. I have a function that is coming up at Club Giroir in San Antonio.
And Club what?
Club Giroir, is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know.
G-I-R-A-U-D over there by Ursuline Academy.
Okay.
It's a real nice club. And that's geared to both the business community here and the lobby in Austin. I have a country western dance every other year at the Country Gold. Not necessarily for me, because now that's going into a scholarship fund.
Country Dome?
Gold.
Country
Gold. Gold. So on Pearsall Road, it's a country western thing.
Okay.
And then, my mind went blank.
Fundraising. Mm-hmm. You have golf tournament, you mail,
no golf.
Mail solicitation, you call people on the phone.
I do that. I do call people on the phone. And it's really the best way, actually, when you send out tickets, you know, it's the best way. Or if you're involved in a re-election campaign, what you want to do is sit down and the way I've done it in the past, I have an individual in Austin. She gets on the phone, she dials, she asks for the individual. She'll tell him, say, you know, Senator Madeline needs to visit with you. You get on the phone and you talk. It's really the most effective way of doing it. I hate to ask for money. I just hate to ask for money. I'm not a good fundraiser. I'm very lax in that area. I've just been very fortunate that the money has come in. I'm up here today, for example, in Albuquerque, and I've got a fundraiser coming up in September, and I'm not going to be there.
Well, let's go back to the House. Why is it that the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus does not come together to push one issue at every session?
Well, I think there have been times when they have come together. I just don't think that there is a consensus on what one issue is the most important for the Mexicano. And you know, I think part of it is the reality that, let's say we wanted to make education as the single. The fact that we have right now Republican leadership, you're not gonna generate any additional revenue. And without money, you're not gonna improve the quality of that education.
I know that's the reality of the day, but...
Back then?
Yeah, we gave our votes for the speaker, we gave our votes for the party, we had Democratic leadership top to bottom. And yet, what strikes me is that the caucus, as far as I know, never would come and say, okay, let's just push one thing. What can we do? Whether it's education or driver's licenses for undocumented or immunization, something.
There were some times when we did come together. I'm trying to think of, there was a bill, and I don't remember if I can explain it correctly. There was a bill that the caucus had promoted session after session. And so they came to me and asked me to carry it, only because I was very close to Speaker Gib Lewis. And basically what it did, it allowed a Mexican national to come across to Texas and fill prescriptions if it was necessary. Now, it's kind of the reverse of us going over there. And the reason for that was that sometimes the medications that they needed were not available in Mexico. And so that bill had been killed two or three sessions in a row. And so I carried it, and I was just very lucky that I was in the right place at the right time and knew the right people. We passed that bill only because we caught the House asleep. The bill was dead. It was about 150 on the last night of the session, way down at the bottom. The only way to get it passed is find a bill that you can amend somewhere else. There was only one bill that dealt with medicine that was before me. And there was a bill that dealt with veterinarians. I mean, nowhere near what I needed. So I said, well, let's try it. you know, I went to the senator, and he says, yeah, he fortunately represented the border area. And the House member that was carrying it was from Sanderson. And so they both agreed. He says, but if we get into trouble, you got to pull your amendment down. I said, it's not a problem. I'll pull it down. I'm not going to let you lose your bill. Well, shit, the word got around, you know. And I went and put it up on the speaker's desk. And people were watching the last night, especially then, because things were left up to the last minute. Now we sign and die hours in advance. So then people were just watching to see who was going up there with amendments. And I went up there, and the parliamentarian went, no, no, no. Not germane. I said, well, I know it's not germane. And then, you know, I was arguing with him to please let me put this damn amendment on this bill. And this Gib Lewis leaned over and says, what's the problem? He says, Mr. Speaker, this amendment is not germane. And you said, no more germane amendments. He said, that's right, Frank. I announced it over the speaker. I said, all right, Gib, do me a favor. I said, why don't you go tell the Mexicans that this amendment is not germane? He told the parliamentarian, Johnson, this is the last non-germane amendment. and then the problem was that people were coming to me and says, we understand you're going to put an amendment on the veterinarian bill that deals with prescription medicine. I said, well, there's an amendment up there that I have up there too. And I knew they're going to knock it off on a point of order. It's dead. So I went up to a guy named Mark Stiles. He and I had worked on two or three bills. Big guy, had a beard. I said, I need to talk to you, Mark. He said, what? I said, I got an amendment that's really important to Hispanics. So I told him what it did. He said, man, look, you ain't ever going to get that amendment on. I said, no, I can't get it on. I said, but you can. Because they're not watching you. They're watching me. He says, damn, he went and looked at his friend. I said, look, if you get caught, I'll go up and I'll try to explain it. To raise a point of order is dead. He got up and he mumbled it. And before the House knew it, the bill had passed. That was before cell phones. The lobbyist for the pharmacist was sitting up in the gallery and he's going bananas because he thinks I forgot to put the amendment on. The truth of the matter, I didn't pass a bill, Mark Stiles said. But there were issues like that that it just was never reported, you know, by the media that the Hispanics came together on this. We came together on some issues. Probably not as many as we should have, but we did.
Okay. Well, how does work in the Senate differ from work in the House? And let's talk about your Senate career and whatever you want to say about current stuff now or the change in politics now with Republicans in charge.
You know, the House is somewhat different only because of the large number of individuals and the fact that the budgets for the members are not as large. And so, to some degree, the House member has to be so much better prepared than a senator. You go to the back, or you go to that front mic, and you carry a bill, you've got 149 guys that can come at you. On the Senate side, you know, I guess it's what my daughter calls a senatorial. You know, we don't embarrass each other until right now. You know, we have a bill, we go up, we visit with them, which is the value of the two-thirds rule to suspend is you talk to 21 members, you got the votes, you don't have any problem. You know if you've got problems before you lay out that bill, because if you don't have 21 votes, you don't bring it up. But on the House side, you get up and you may think you don't have any problems, and before there's a line in the bag, you know, grilling you. And so you've got to be very well prepared. In some ways, I think the House is more fun. It's more exciting. There's more drama simply because there's more personalities. The Senate is, you know, a little bit more organized. It's more diplomatic. We try not to embarrass each other. And there are some good debates, but that's kind of the difference between House and the Senate. Of course, the situation with those of us who are in Albuquerque right now, it's changed dramatically. I don't think it's Democrat Republican, though. I think what you're seeing is really a white Republican majority in the Senate that are basically
Senator Taylor's. Yeah. Yeah. Come on. 236. All right.
It's that white Republican majority that is there that is basically, you know, I guess you want to say penalize the Hispanics and the African Americans and the two white members who represent minority districts for doing what their constituents wanted, and that was to stop redistricting at any cost. That's why we're here.
What about the workload? You know, there's only 31 of you. You got to handle all the work of 150 plus the speaker's agenda. And
well, we have a lot of staff. We have more staff than they do, and if it weren't for that, we'd be in trouble. Yeah, it's heavy. I carry between 90 and 120 bills a session, and yeah, it drives you crazy. I mean, you're running from one committee to the other, and it works the staff.
How can you afford this now? The salary isn't all that much. How much do you make as a senator? Same thing as
I take home $4.39.
What is the constitutional salary? 8,000
something? It's 7,200.
7,200, okay.
But by the time they deduct everything every month, I get $4.32. I can't even go to Whataburger, you know, with what I get paid. Why do I do it? Same reason. I'm interested in helping people. And I've started a project on the South Side trying to bring Texas A&M in. And I want to be able to see that project through. I'm beginning to see some light at the end of the tunnel. Obviously, you know, I'm 66. You know, it may be some time down the road. Maybe not this. I may run one more time, and then I'm just going to let it perhaps some younger soul to come in and take over. But I want to finish those projects that I started and see what I can do.
Any last words about anything that we didn't cover that you want to touch on, or leave it in the record?
Well, you know, all I can tell you is that serving has been a real pleasure, you know, and it's been financially for me and my family very, very difficult. It has been, but it's been rewarding. I sell insurance. I've got some money that comes in from that, which is one thing that helps me to be here. I got three small, very small consulting contracts. And they kind of give me that independence to stay here, only because my wife doesn't work anymore.
Does the farm generate any income?
No, just bills.
Any hunting leases? Is there any woods left? Any deer left?
No, there's nothing left. You can't tell the deer from the dogs. They're so small. But you know, it's something that you learn to live with. You learn to live with, and it's hard, and it's unfair to the family. But it makes you tough. It brings you close together. I've had a good political career. I'm very proud of it.
Senator, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jose.